Tickets are on sale now at eventbrite.com and Red Cat Records. Presented by MRG Concerts, CITR Radio, and Discorder Magazine.
Tonight, we take pleasure in bringing you Suspense, a weekly anthology of notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense.
Effie, what the devil are you up to?
I'm just looking at the moon. It's green.
Close the shutters at once, you little fool, and come away from the window.
Green as a beer bottle. Green as emeralds. Green as leaves with sunshine striking through them. And green as grass to lie on.
Effie!
All right, I'm closing the shutters.
You know that those shutters are not to be touched. Not for 5 more years, at least.
I only wanted to look at the moon.
Only wanted to die like a little fool and make me that much more ashamed of you. Here, count yourself. Good Lord.
Oh, just the radium dial on this old wristwatch I keep in my pocket.
You imbecile. You incredible imbecile.
Sorry.
I do suppose you still realize the sort of world you're living in.
A world where hydrogen bombs were tossed about with such reckless abandon that even now the sky is hazed with death. Radioactive dust that plays fantastic tricks with the light of sun and moon. A world where the only chance for existence was to retire to shelter underground. Shelter seized by the strong and defended by them against the desperate hordes of the dying until there were no more of those. A world that consists only of waiting and enduring. No beauty or tenderness, just fear and guilt. Oh yes, I realize what sort of world I live in.
You understand too, I suppose, that we were allowed to reclaim this ground-level apartment only because the committee believed us to be responsible people. And because I've been making a damn good showing lately.
Yes, Hank.
I thought you were eager for privacy. You want to go back to the basement tenements?
No, Hank.
Then why aren't you more careful? I've told you a million times, Effie. That glass is no protection against the dust that's outside that window. The lead shutter must never be touched. If you make one single slip like that and it gets around, the committee will send us back to the lower levels without blinking an eye. And they'll think twice before trusting me with any important jobs.
I'm sorry, Hank.
Sorry? What's the good of being sorry? The only thing that counts is never to make a slip. Why the devil do you do such things, Effie? What drives you to it?
It's just that it's so dreadful being cooped up like this, shut away from the sky and the sun. I'm just hungry for a little beauty.
And do you suppose I'm not? Don't you suppose I want to get outside too and be carefree and have a good time? But I'm not so damned selfish about it. I want my children to enjoy the sun, and my children's children. Don't you see that that's the all-important thing, and that we have to behave like mature adults and make sacrifices for it?
Yes, Hank.
You're a fine one to talk about hunger for beauty. You haven't forgotten, have you, Effie, that until last month, the committee was so concerned about your sterility that they were about to enter my name on the list of those waiting to be allotted a free woman? Very high on the list, too.
No, I haven't forgotten.
But now that you're going to have a child, that's all in the background again. Do you know, Effie, that when I first came in, I had some very good news for you. I'm about to become a member of the junior committee. The announcement will be made at the banquet tonight. So brighten yourself up and put on your best dress. I want the other juniors to see what a handsome wife the new member has got. Well, get a move on!
I'm terribly sorry, Hank, but you'll have to go alone. I'm not well.
Oh, there you go again! First that infantile, inexcusable business of the shutters, and now this! No feelings for my reputation at all. Don't be ridiculous, Effie. You're coming.
I'm terribly sorry, but I really can't. I'd just be sick. I wouldn't make you proud of me at all.
Of course you won't. As it is, I have to spend half my energy running around making excuses for you. Why you're so odd. Why you always seem to be ailing. Why you're always stupid and snobbish and say the wrong thing. But tonight's really important, Effie. It will cause a lot of bad comment if the new member's wife isn't present. You know how just a hint of sickness starts the old radiation disease rumor going. You've got to come, Effie. Oh, for heaven's sake, come on! This is just a silly mood. As soon as you get going, you'll snap out of it. There's nothing really wrong with you at all.
Hank, please.
Really?
Yes.
Well, of course, that's the way it is. So you don't care enough about your old husband's success to make one supreme effort in spite of feeling bad.
I just can't go out tonight, under any circumstances.
Well, it can't be helped, naturally. And I certainly wouldn't want you to go if you weren't able to enjoy it. So you hop right into bed and get a good rest. I'll run over to the men's dorm to freshen up.
Oh, Hank, that's not necessary.
No, really, it's no trouble at all. I don't want you to have to make any effort at all. Incidentally, Jim Barnes isn't going to be able to come to the banquet either. Touch of the old flu, he tells me, of all things. I got a bit sharp with you, I'm afraid, Effie. I'm sorry about that. I was excited about my new job, and I guess that was why things upset me. Made me feel let down when I found out you weren't feeling as good as I was. Oh, selfish of me. Now you get into bed right away and get well. Don't worry about me a bit. I know you'd come if you possibly could, and I know you'll be thinking of me. Well, I must be off now. You'll be completely alone for the next 4 hours.
No, it couldn't have been. I must be seeing things. Still, I should look and be sure. No, it was just an illusion, some silly romantic dream. There couldn't be anything alive outside. There hasn't been for 2 whole years. Then, there's no harm in looking just once more, I suppose. It's so hard to see through the glass. Maybe if I open the window just for a moment. Nothing.
Is it tears I get for a welcome, or are those only to greet God's own breath, the air? Don't be afraid.
I'm not.
Then why don't you let me in?
I don't know.
It's okay. I don't bite. Go on.
The window. Close it, please.
All right. It's a snug enough place you and your man have. Or is it that this is just a free-love town or a harem spot, or just a military post? But let's not talk about such things now. Soon enough I'll be scared to death for both of us. Best enjoy the kick of meeting, which is always good for 20 minutes at the least. Have you food?
Yes, I'll fix you something.
Something quick, please.
All right.
Thank you.
What's it like up there? Outside, I mean.
Oh, it's a wonderland for sure. More amazing than you tomb folk could ever imagine. A veritable fairyland.
No, really.
I mean it. You think the bombs and the dust made only death and ugliness. That was true at first. But then, just as the doctors foretold, they changed the life in the seeds and loins that were brave enough to stay. Wonders bloomed and walked. Do any of you ever venture outside?
A few of the men are allowed to for short trips in special protective suits to hunt for canned food, fuel, batteries, and things like that.
Aye. And those blind salt slugs would never see anything but what they're looking for. They'd never see the garden where a dozen buds bloom where just one did before. And the flowers have petals a yard across with stingless bees as big as sparrows gently supping their nectar. House cats, grown spotted and huge as leopards, stalk through those gardens, but they're gentle beasts, no more harmful than the rainbow-scaled snakes that glide around their paws. For the dust burned all the murder out of them, as it burned itself out. I've even made up a little poem about that. It starts... Fire can hurt me, or water, or the weight of earth, but the dust is my friend. Oh, yes, and then the robins like cockatoos and squirrels like a princess's ermine, all under their treasure chest of sun and moon and stars that the dust's magic powder changes from ruby to emerald to sapphire and amethyst and then back again. Oh, and then the new children.
You're telling the truth? You're not making it up?
I am not. And if you could catch a glimpse of one of the new children, you'd never doubt me again. They have long limbs as brown as coffee would be if it had lots of fresh cream in it, and smiling, delicate faces, and the whitest teeth and the finest hair. They're so nimble that I, a sprightly man and somewhat enlivened by the dust, feel like a cripple beside them. And their thoughts dance like flames and make me feel like a very imbecile. Of course, they have 7 fingers on each hand and 8 toes on each foot, but they're more beautiful for that. They have large pointed ears that the sun shines through. They play in the garden all day long, slipping amongst the green leaves and the blooms, but they're so swift that you can hardly see them unless one chooses to stand still and look at you. For that matter, you have to look a bit hard for all these things I'm telling you.
But is it true?
Every word of it. What's your name? Mine's Patrick.
Effie.
No, that can't be. Euphemia? That's what Effie is short for. Your name is Euphemia.
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 Yes?
I...
Don't either of you move.
Hank!
You whore. You filthy little whore. And not even with a man of the community. No, it had to be with a pariah. A pariah!
I know what you're thinking, man, but you're quite wrong. I just happened to be coming by hungry tonight, a lonely tramp, and knocked at the window. Your wife was a bit foolish and let kind-heartedness get the better of prudence.
Don't think you've pulled the wool over my eyes, Effie. Don't think I don't know why you're suddenly going to have a child after 4 long years. Even that business of carrying the wristwatch in your pocket instead of on your arm. A neat bit of camouflage, Effie. Very neat. And telling me it was my child, when all the while you've been seeing him for months!
Man, you're mad. I've not even touched her.
Pretending you were going to give me a healthy child, when all the while you knew it would be a thing like him. I should shoot him down. I should kill him this instant for the contaminated pariah he is.
Then you'd be killing the bringer of the best news we've ever had. Oh, Hank, forget your silly wrong jealousy and listen to me. Patrick here has something wonderful to tell us.
What do you mean?
I mean that we no longer need fear the dust. It never really did hurt people the way the doctor said it would. Remember how it was with me, Hank? The exposure I had and recovered from, although the doctor said I wouldn't at first. And without even losing my hair, Hank, those who were brave enough to stay outside and who weren't killed by terror and suggestion and panic, they adapted to the dust. They changed, but they changed for the better. Everything.
Effie! He told you lies.
Everything that grew or moved was purified. You men going outside have never seen it because you've never had eyes for it. You've been blinded to beauty, to life itself. And now all the power in the dust has gone and faded. Anyway, burned itself out. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
You see, Hank, we can all go out now. We need never fear the dust again. Patrick is living proof of that. Look at him. Not a scar or a sign. And he's been out in the dust for years. How could he be this way if the dust hurt the brave? Oh, believe me, Hank. Believe what you see. Test it if you want. Test Patrick here.
Effie, you're all mixed up. You don't know what you're talking about.
Look.
Just test him.
All right. You. Can you count?
Can I count? Do you take me for a complete simpleton, man? Of course I can count.
Then count yourself.
Count myself, should I? Is this a kindergarten? But if you want me to, I'm willing. I have two arms and two legs. That's four. And 10 fingers and 10 toes. You'll take my word for them. That's 24. A head, 25. And 2 eyes and a nose and a mouth.
With this, I mean. The Geiger counter.
Very well.
Enough radioactive to kill 1,000 men. Freak! Freak!
No!
Have we listened to this racket long enough? That's right. You both do well to cringe from me, for I am death itself. Even in death, I could kill you like a snake. Yes, I'm a freak, as the gentleman so wisely said. That's what one doctor who dared talk with me for a minute told me before he kicked me out. He couldn't tell me why, but somehow the dust doesn't kill me. Because I'm a freak, you see. Just like the man who ate nails and walked on fire and ate arsenic and stuck themselves through with pins. Step right up, ladies and gentlemen, only not too close, and examine the man who dust can't harm. Rappuccini's child, brought up to date. His embrace, death. And now, I'll get out and leave you in your damned lead cave.
Wait!
What?
When we were together earlier, you didn't act as if...
We... When we were together earlier, I wanted what I wanted. You don't suppose I'm a bloody saint, do you?
But all the beautiful things you told me...
Oh, that... Just a line I've found that women fall for. They're all so bored and so starved for beauty, as they generally put it.
Even the garden!
What's outside is just a little worse than either of you can imagine. The garden's all up here. In my head.
Me. You've both killed everything that's beautiful. But you, Patrick, you're worse. He only killed beauty once, but you brought it to life just so you could kill it all over again. Oh, I can't stand it. I won't stand it. You've been lying to us. The garden's there. I know it is, but you don't want to share it with anyone.
No, 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 Euphemia. It's hell out there, believe me. I wouldn't lie to you about it.
Wouldn't lie to me? You've done nothing but lie to me.
Effie!
I can't be cooped up here any longer, and I won't now that I know. I'm going to the garden.
No!
Effie, come back! Come back! I love you, Effie! Come back!
Come back, Euphemia. You'll be safe if you come back right away. Come back to your home. Go out and get her, man. For if I go out for her, I warn you, I won't bring her back.
But...
she said something about having stood the dust better than most. That's enough for me.
I...
as you wish.
Fire can't hurt me, or water, or the weight of earth, but the dust is my friend.
Effie. Count myself.
So ends The Moon is Green by John C. Alsadek and Dana Perry Hayes. Tonight's story of Suspense. Suspense is produced by Blue Hours Productions and recorded at Melrose Music in Hollywood, California. Tonight's radio drama was adapted for radio by John C. Alsadek and Dana Perry Hayes from the short story by Fritz Leiber Jr. Jane Casserly was Effie. Joe Ockman was Hank. Darren Jacobs was Patrick. I'm John C. Alsadek. Next week at this time, tune in again for another study in Suspense.
This Quarter Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, This Quarter lives. Favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder magazine or at rickshawtheater.com. To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, When you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism, as opposed to someone who buys, like you know, all the clothing. Let's say, you know, someone buys a clothing.
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Cool. Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
We present Nigel Anthony in The Hornblower Story, adapted from four of the C.S. Forrester novels by Val Gielgud. Part two, from Mr. Midshipman Hornblower, The Cargo of Rice.
You will hear some people talk as if all life in the Navy afloat is much the same thing. You can take it from me that they don't know what they're talking about. Service in a ship of the line, like the Justinian, in which I started my career as midshipman, and service in a frigate, like the Indefatigable, Captain Sir Edward Pellew, was as different as chalk from cheese. In a ship of the line, no midshipman could hope to be more than an unconsidered trifle. In a frigate, there was usually the chance of taking prizes, and a prize might mean an independent command, if one only had the luck. An independent command. I thought of it all day and dreamt of it all night. Indefatigable was pounding through Biscay in a heavy sea and under a strong breeze. The waters of the bay were dotted with white sails, the sails of the stragglers from a French convoy, trying to make their home ports, while, out in the Atlantic, their escorting fleet was at grips with our own. Ship after ship was overhauled. A shot or two, their newfangled tricolour flag came down, and a prize crew was sent on board. Captain Pellew was not a man who wasted time, as I soon discovered. An experienced captain and a young midshipman can go well together. The brig we were chasing was slow to surrender. On that heaving sea, it was hard to bring our 9-pounders accurately to bear. I was beside Sir Edward on the quarter-deck.
Not into our hull, dammit! I want her crippled, not sunk! That's better! Got the slings of a fore-topsail yard. Now she must come up into the wind. My speaking trumpet, Mr. Hornblower, if you please.
Aye, aye, sir.
What rigs there? What does the fellow say?
Marie Galant to Bordeaux. 24 days out from New Orleans with rice.
Oh, rice, a revolutionary France, eh? That'll sell for a pretty penny when we get her home. 200 tons, I'd say. Crew, 12 at most. She'll need a prize crew of four, a midshipman's command. See what you can do, Mr. Hornblower.
Me, sir?
Take 4 men of the cutter's crew and board that brig. Mr. Soames will give you our position. Take her into any English port you can make and report there for orders.
Aye, aye, sir.
It was no joke jumping from the mizzen chains into the cutter with that sea running, but it was no time to hesitate under Sir Edward's eye. I had my dirk and a pistol, and the master gave me a paper with our latitude and longitude hastily scrawled. By nature, I was always ungainly and awkward, but better make an exhibition of myself than delay indefatigable any longer. I jumped and cannoned clumsily into the lieutenant in the stern sheets.
What the deuce do you want, Hornblower?
Sorry, sir. Orders. Would you take me to the brig, sir?
You taking charge of her?
Yes, sir. The captain requests I should take 4 of your men.
They better be topmen. That topsail yard of theirs is all adrift. Shall I pick them for you?
I'd be obliged, sir.
Jones?
Aye,
Baker?
Aye, sir.
Grant and Matthews?
Aye.
Keep them away from drink and they'll be all right. And watch the French crew, or they'll retake the ship and land you in a French jail.
Aye, aye, sir.
Lay to there, Matthews. Lay to.
The first thing that struck my eyes as I boarded the French brig was the profusion of bottles. There was a pile of them around the hatch cover. Others were rolling about the scuppers. Matthews, evidently the accepted leader of the men from the cutter, regarded bottles and Frenchmen alike with a contempt he did not try to conceal.
By the holy, they made the best of their time, sir. Wish we were as happy.
That'll do, Matthews. Jones! Grant! Brace the after yards to larboard!
Aye, aye, sir!
I'll take the wheel myself. You're rated petty officer, Matthews. Get to work at once and clear away that raffle forward.
Aye, aye, sir.
Get that jib in before it floods itself to pieces!
Aye, aye, sir!
We'll need more hands than we have, sir. Can I put some of the Frenches to work?
If you think you can, and they're sober enough.
I'll work them all right. Drunk or sober, sir.
Very good. Carry on. We'll square away.
What's your call, sir?
For England. Northeast by north. Oh, Matthews.
Sir?
One of those shots we fired looked as if it hulled her. What's the damage?
Don't rightly know, sir.
We must take a closer look as soon as we can. Better sound the well now.
Aye, aye, sir. I'll need a sounding line and a light. I'll get them, sir. All right that I can see, sir. Not a drop. Dry as yesterday's pannikin.
You're certain?
Sure as I'm alive, sir.
Very good, Matthews. Coil that rope again.
Aye, aye, sir. You'll pardon me, Mr. Hornblower, but we can't keep that course as you set much longer, with the wind coming up gusty-like.
Thank you, Matthews. Summon all hands and wear ship. We couldn't weather Ushant on this tack with things as they are.
I was to get no sleep that night. Short-handed, I did not dare to continue in the hope that the wind might back. I remembered my reading and instructions warning me of the terrors of a lee shore. The thought of taking help from my French prisoners stuck in my gullet, but I could see no help for it. I sent below for their captain. I did not care for the look of him when he appeared. Unshaven, bleary-eyed.
Votre nom, monsieur.
I speak English. 5 years I spent in one of your Portsmouth hulks during the last war. My name is Jules Leblanc, lieutenant.
I'm Horatio Hornblower, midshipman.
Monsieur Hornblower, my men are hungry.
No doubt. Mine are. I am.
I have a cook aboard.
Fortunate. Then we can come to terms.
Terms?
Simple enough. Your cook will provide food for everyone on board the Marie Galante. You undertake that you and your men will make no attempt to recapture the ship.
The wind is set foul for England, monsieur.
That fact has not entirely escaped me.
And we ride a little heavily, is it not so?
Maybe.
A leak, perhaps.
Her well has been sounded. Not a drop of water in her.
One shot from your frigate struck our hull. You know that we carry a cargo of rice, monsieur.
I do.
You know also, should there be a leak, Every drop of water taken in by the ship would be absorbed by the rice. Sounding of the well would tell you nothing.
Where do you think the shot hit her?
On the port side, forward.
You were close-hauled and heeling over when we hit you. If there is a leak, it must be below the waterline. I'll go and see.
You do not send one of your men?
I prefer to see for myself. Our terms. They are agreed, Monsieur Leblanc.
You have my hand on it.
Good enough. Matthews! Get a line rigged. I'm going over the side. You'll take charge, Mr. Matthews.
Aye, aye, sir.
If I find there's a hole, we must father a sail and get it over somehow to plug the leak. Monsieur Leblanc here has promised that his cook will feed us. Better take advantage of his offer.
The wave closed over my head like a momentary death. And there it was, 2 feet below the waterline, a splintered, jagged hole, square rather than round, and at least a foot across. At that moment, I fancied I could hear the sea bubbling into the ship.
Well, you were right, sir.
The Frenchman was right, Matthews. That leak must be plugged, and we've little time to spare.
I doubt if we've time at all, sir.
What do you mean?
Look there, sir. That deck seam and the pitch bulging out of it.
Mon Dieu! The cargo, it increases itself.
What the devil do you mean?
It's the rice, sir. The water's got into it and it's swelling. It'll burst the ship's seams open, sir.
Then the sooner we get a sail over the leak, the better, Matthews.
If it's possible, sir.
Of course it's possible.
I said she was riding heavily, monsieur. Now you can see. She's already much lower in the water.
You keep an eye on your own people, Monsieur Leblanc. We cannot afford any panic. Hurry with that sail, Matthews!
Aye, aye, sir!
And have her laid on the starboard tack!
But on this present tack, we can easily make Bordeaux. Surely you will not risk all our lives.
That be damned for a tale.
I beg your pardon, sir.
Don't like the feel of her. She's settling down.
We'll see about that. I'll jettison the cargo. Get all the Frenchmen forward. Tail on to those tackles and sway up the hatch.
This is madness.
Of course, we'll do our best, sir. But it seems to me she's settling fast.
I don't have to tell you twice to obey orders, Matthews. Are we going to be beaten by some rats and a few tons of rice? And you, Monsieur Leblanc, if your men don't want to drown, let me see them start working.
Matthews drove the French seaman to work with a rope's end. He and my other three strained and heaved like heroes. But after at least 50 tons of cargo had been hoisted out and flung overside, the brig was a full 6 inches lower in the water. Now she was leaking like a basket, the water pouring in through the gaping seams, only to be sucked up immediately by the thirsty rice. There was only one thing to do.
Matthews, prepare to abandon ship.
Aye, aye, sir.
Grâce à Dieu.
Best find yourself some warm clothes, Mr. Hornblower, sir. I've been once in an open boat for 10 days.
Thank you. Think of yourself. And Matthews, see what you can find. Navigating instruments, charts, a compass.
Aye, aye, sir.
Monsieur Leblanc.
What can I do?
We shall be 17 in all. Heavy manning for your wretched little boat. See that your men lay hands on all the food and water they can manage.
At your service, monsieur.
You'll take the tiller, Matthews. You'll handle an overloaded boat better than I can. I shall leave the ship last, of course.
Too bad we couldn't save her, sir.
Just so. Now, get along.
Aye, aye, sir.
The brig was now so waterlogged that it was almost easy to step down from her deck into the boat. I looked back as we pulled away. The Marie Galante had acquired a sudden list. Then she righted herself, her deck nearly level with the sea, and sank almost on an even keel, her masts slowly disappearing. For an instant, her sails gleamed under the green water.
She's gone, Mr. Hornblower.
Yes, she's gone. And I'm thinking...
Yes, sir?
My first independent command.
It's the luck, sir.
You're right, Matthews. It's the luck. What's the use of thinking about it?
She's gone. At any rate, we're still alive.
That's about it, sir. We're alive.
There's usually a funny side to things.
Funny, Mr. Hornblower? Begging pardon, but what's so funny about this lot?
I'm going to be sick. Shift out of my way, Matthews, will you?
It was a bad time in that open boat. As bad a time as I can remember in all my years at sea. The Frenchman huddled in the bows, Monsieur Leblanc amidships by himself, my four men with me in the stern. 2 nights without sleep. Wet, cold, and that damned seasickness of mine. Not to speak of the thoughts which nagged me of how I'd lost my first command. At 17, you let these things get under your skin. A biscuit of hard bread and half a pannikin of water didn't offer much in the shape of consolation.
Mast step, sir. Luxow bent. And ready to hoist.
Wind's backing westerly, little Matthews. We'll make sail. You'll keep the tiller. Baker, take the sheet. Close hauled on the port tack.
Close hauled it'll be, sir.
Where do we go, monsieur?
North.
But the wind is fair for Bordeaux. By tomorrow we could be there. Why should we go north?
Because we're bound for England.
England? It'll be a week, a whole week, even if the wind stays fair. In this so crowded boat. It is madness. Should there be a storm?
Then we shall drown together. Let me tell you once again, Monsieur Leblanc, that I do not intend to rot for years in a French prison.
But I insist that you head for Bordeaux.
It would be hard to miss you at about 5 feet. There is a second pistol in my belt over my left hip. Take it, Matthews.
Got it, sir. Begging your pardon, but hadn't you better cock yours?
You will please point that pistol another way.
I only want to make it quite plain that if you or any of your men makes a threatening move, my petty officer or I will shoot.
Monsieur Hornblower, I beg you to listen to me. As I told you, I was in prison in England during the last war. It is not an experience I wish to repeat. Let us come to an agreement and sail to France. We will land anywhere you choose. Then you can continue your journey freely. Or I will use all my influence to have you and your men sent back to England without stipulation for exchange or ransom. This I swear.
No.
Is it not a fair offer?
Your government would never part with trained seamen like mine on representation from you. They're too valuable.
But I assure you...
It is also my duty to see that your trained seamen do not return to France.
That is your final word?
Yes.
Shall I clout his jaw and shut him up?
That'll not be necessary, I think, Mr. Matthews.
At least, put your pistol away. It is dangerous.
You give me your word that you will do nothing to interfere with my command of this boat?
I swear it.
And your men?
I undertake for them.
Very well.
It was after breakfast the next morning that we sighted the sail. Naturally, we rejoiced, until Matthew suggested she might be French. She was flush-decked, with a look of speed about her and a line of gun ports. And as Matthews pointed out, she hadn't all possible sail set, as a ship travelling on peaceful business would normally have had in such a breeze. Matthews was right. She was a French privateer. She came tearing down on us, passed it at half a cable's length, hove to and cut off our escape. We could only curse and submit. When we stepped onto her deck, I was greeted by a young man in a plum-coloured coat with a lace stock.
I am Captain Neuville of the privateer P. May I inquire?
Midshipman Hornblower of His Britannic Majesty's Navy.
Do not distress yourself. The fortunes of war... Until we make port, you will be accommodated in the peak, with all comfort possible. But those pistols in your belt, they must surely discommode you. Let me relieve you of the weight.
Here.
And that dirk you wear? Impetuous youth often leads to some rashness. That would be a pity.
Take it.
1,000 thanks. Matter show you to the berth that is prepared for you below.
I should appreciate the company of my petty officer.
As you wish. If you will follow me. Our market in San Domingo has been closed by recent events. I converted the pig into a privateer so that I might still draw my dividends. Also, under our Nobel Committee of Public Safety, I found Paris an unhealthy spot for a gentleman. So I choose to command myself.
I expect you know your own business.
I think so. Here are your cuts. Should the ship go into action, the hatches above will be battened down. Otherwise, you are free to move about as you will. I would only add that any attempt by prisoners to interfere with the working or welfare of the pig might be deeply resented by her crew. They serve with me on shares, you understand. Anyone seeking to endanger their freedom or their dividends might easily find himself overboard.
You are very frank, sir.
It is well we understand one another. Now, is there anything further I can provide for your comfort? Apart from the society of your excellent petty officer. Pray, step inside.
Thank you.
Something to read?
If you can refresh.
I can.
I have some professional books. I recommend to you Lebrun's Handbook on Seamanship.
That will do very well, monsieur. I may rely on your care for the welfare of my three other men.
Master Guest takes a turn at pumping out the ship.
I protest, sir. That sort of menial work.
We will not discuss it, if you please.
Damned mincing fellow.
I'll get my hands on him by and by, sir.
You will keep your hands to yourself, Matthews, unless I tell you to the contrary.
Aye, aye, sir. Begging your pardon, Mr. Hornblower, but being in here with you like this, sir.
I like company. Don't you?
But you an officer, sir.
It is perfectly fitting, Matthews, and it is my responsibility.
Very good, sir. This is the soft of the two cots, sir.
And I'll take the other. Damn it, Matthews. If only I'd had the sense to get that shot hole in the Marigold plugged a bit earlier, we shouldn't be in this pickle.
Hardly your fault, Mr. Hornblower.
Incompetence is always a fault. And it looks as if I shall pay for it by celebrating my 18th birthday in a French prison.
It was a damnable situation, with little to do but brood on my failure which had brought me to this fix. For days we cruised in the channel approaches and saw nothing but a tossing waste of water. Then one morning, Matthews and I were both on deck. There came a hail from the masthead of a ship visible to windward. She altered course towards us, and the peak stood towards her, all sails set for pursuit. Or flight.
I wonder, Matthews...
By God, sir, it's the old Indefatigable, no less.
We are on the edge of her cruising ground. All the same, it's long odds against.
I'm not mistaken, sir. I'd swear to it.
You may be right, Matthews.
There, she's loosing her royals. We'll be back aboard in time for grog.
She must first catch us.
Did I hear your petty officer or have Monsieur Rambler? That is your red ship?
She may be.
In that case, you can tell me. What is her best point of sailing?
I think not.
Such nobility or attitude is out of place. I could induce you to give me the information. But fortunately for you, it is not necessary. There is not one of His Britannic Majesty's clumsy frigates that cannot sail the peak running before the wind. However, in the circumstances, I fancy you and your companion would be more comfortable below.
I prefer fresh air.
Yet, you will obey my orders. Below, monsieur. You will please go below.
Matthews.
Aye, aye, sir.
That door in the after bulkhead. Did you see it when it was unlocked?
No,
aye. It gives on to the bosun's store. Paint, Matthews, paint!
That door's two solid slabs of wood, sir.
Don't make difficulties, Matthews. Take off your jersey.
My jersey, sir?
And don't ask damn fool questions. Now, unravel it. Then, slash open that cot mattress and scoop out the ticking. And here's a use at last for Monsieur Lebrun's treatise on seamanship. The grease from the lamp. Spread it abroad.
We'll be grilled like herrings, Mr. Hornblower.
We've got to risk that.
Get up on deck again.
We was ordered below.
Get on deck! Argue. Do what you like or what you can, but stay there.
What about you, sir?
Do as you're told. I'll join you in a minute or two. Jump to it, Matthews.
I was committed. I grabbed the lamp and smashed it onto the torn paper and scattered straw. The flame caught, spread and flared. I followed Matthews. On deck, Neuville was watching the helmsman with occasional glances aloft to see that every sail was doing its work. The men were at the guns, two hands heaving the log. How much longer would I have? As it turned out, it was long enough. Nothing was so feared in our wooden ships as fire. A rush of flame shot through a cabin skylight. Neuville brought the peak about, and head to wind, it kept the fire from the magazine. The other sails did not catch. For all that, the peak was helpless. She could neither fight nor run. Captain Pellew had seen the smoke and drawn his conclusions. The Indefatigable tore down, the white wave foaming underneath her bowsprit, and hoisted out her boats a cable's length to windward. The tricolor flag fluttered down. It remained for me to face Captain Sir Edward Pellew. And, as I went aboard Indefatigable, I could have wished myself elsewhere.
Glad to see you aboard again, Mr. Hornblower.
Thank you, sir.
That privateer, I know something of the self-styled Captain Neuville and of his record. A private menace and a public danger, Mr. Hornblower.
Yes, sir.
You agree with me?
I was his prisoner, sir.
How did he treat you?
I have no complaints for myself.
Your men?
He might have treated them better.
Quite so. I should have expected as much. Well, with a little hard work, the peak can be repaired, sent to England and then to sea again. What is more important, she's no longer available in French hands to prey on English commerce. As for yourself, Mr. Hornblower...
I cannot excuse myself, sir. The Mary Gallant had been hulled below the waterline when I boarded her. I should have realized...
Mr. Hornblower, pray do not make a great fuss about very little.
I beg your pardon, sir.
The Marie Gallant was damaged by gunfire before she surrendered. No one can establish now whether that damage was small or great. I sent you aboard with a prize crew of four. They were all I could spare. You did what you could to save her. You failed.
The responsibility was mine, sir.
It was also mine. Furthermore, Mr. Hornblower, it was more important that France should be deprived of that cargo of rice than England should benefit by it.
You are indulgent to me, sir.
Am I indeed? That is a matter for my lords of the Admiralty.
Sir.
In reporting the matter, I shall of course bring to their lordships' attention the circumstances of the taking of the peak. In that case, also her capture is of considerable benefit to our country.
If you say so, sir.
I do say so. Fortunate she caught fire like that. She was running away from us and would have been out of sight in an hour. Providence, Mr. Hornblower. Or have you any idea how it happened? Well, speak up.
I think it must have been a case of spontaneous combustion in the paint locker. I can't account for it otherwise.
Really, Mr. Hornblower? How very fortunate. Tell me, are you sure that you did not, let us say, nudge Fortune's elbow? I should be glad to include in my report to my lords anything which might serve to favor your future career.
It was the time and my opportunity to answer truthfully and with proper modesty. I might reasonably have expected a modicum of praise, a mention in the gazettes, even perhaps my appointment as acting lieutenant. I could not do it. Sir Edward Pellew did not know the full details of the loss of the Marie Gallant and her cargo of rice. I alone knew how and when I had failed. I alone could decide, and had decided, on the punishment my failure deserved. And more than anything else, I had to re-establish myself in my own eyes.
I can't account for it, sir.
I can't account for it. I repeat it to Sir Edward. And when I had spoken the words, I was conscious of a sudden and enormous relief, of not a single twinge of regret.
In part two of the Hornblower story, you heard Nigel Anthony as Lord Hornblower, the narrator, with Nicholas Fry in the role of Horatio as a youth. Captain Sir Edward Pellew was played by Ronald Herdman, Able Seaman Matthews, David Miller, Captain LeBlanc, Ron Davies, Captain Nerville, Peter Bell, and a Lieutenant, Joe Cook. Location recordings were made by Christopher Hayton Webb and David Fleming Williams aboard the ketch IP Torso. The Hornblower story is directed by Trevor Hill.
Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it Monday
from 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Break your fingers.
And you are tuned into CITR 101.9 FM. That's all the time that we have for Scald's Hall. Stay tuned for a night's worth of music. From all of us here in Vancouver, have a safe and happy